Hello, warriors and supporters. Welcome to CWF Presents CRPS RSD is Real, our very own podcast series in which we interview courageous men and women that work side by side with our warriors. Welcome to episode 2. This week we have Dr. Brigman joining us. He is a world-renowned podiatrist located in Las Vegas. He is going to share with us the role a podiatrist plays in the care of a CRPS warrior, as well as how he approaches treatment, different options he uses, and the significance and importance of having support. So without any further ado, I introduce to you our host and interviewer, Danielle, and Dr. Peter Brigman.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Brigman. I would first and foremost like to begin today by just thanking you so much for allowing us this opportunity to chat with you. I appreciate you taking out that chunk of time in your busy day, especially on a weekend. Much appreciated. Welcome.
Happy to be here. Happy to partake in this. And I look forward to providing the audience with some hopefully valuable information and maybe some insights into not only CRPS itself, but the whole foundation, and hopefully maybe provide some hope and inspiration to people.
That's one of the big things that I'm actually excited for, is that you bring a whole different viewing aspect to a patient, as well as the foundation and health in general. Your passion for helping individuals with CRPS is definitely something to behold. I was enamored with many of your videos and many of the conversations that you've had about it. Personally, as a warrior, I want to thank you very much for furthering your understanding of CRPS and being one of those doctors who truly understands and gives us the space to be a patient with someone who's understanding. If you don't mind my asking, what brought you to work with the foundation and know more about CRPS in general?
Sure. I'm going to say probably about 4 or 5 years ago, I was starting out my new practice, and I was hiring medical assistants. And one of my medical assistants knew Debbie. They were pretty good friends, and I imagine still are. And so at one point she said to me, hey, you know, I was wondering if you'd want to see my friend. She has complex regional pain syndrome and really is kind of, you know, been dealing with it for a while. And maybe you have something you can help her out with. And lo and behold, you know, I met Deb, and, you know, here we are 5 years later or whatever. And so at the time, you know, I knew enough about complex regional pain syndrome to hopefully be able to identify it and treat it appropriately. But seeing her and what a inspiration she was kind of gave me the ability, or I should say the desire, to make it a little more part of my practice and get more involved than probably I would have, because, you know, like any other doctor, I have 7,000 things going on at once. And, you know, even though I specialize, I still have, you know, I treat 15 different things a week, and complex regional pain syndrome, because it's not very common, you know, that's, I might see that at least at this point in my career, maybe once every 3 to 6 months, I get a patient with that. So I'm not seeing a ton of it, which, you know, it may be thankful. You know, I can personally say that I don't think, I was thinking about it this morning because I knew I was going to be doing this podcast, how many times I've actually, let's say, created a complex regional pain syndrome due to surgery where, you know, nothing I could have done or predict, but, or potentially predict, but, and the answer fortunately was zero. So, I have not personally created a complex regional pain syndrome, but I've seen plenty of patients who over the years who, you know, had a surgery and then all of a sudden they've developed complex regional pain syndrome. So that's how I got into it.
That's fantastic that you've had a zero. Thank you very much. Personally, I am one of those patients that I had a major back surgery to decompress my sciatic nerve. I had a disc blow out and crush the nerve. I was paralyzed down one side, but by the time they had released the disc, the damage was sort of done, as they said to me. And I had what they called failed back surgery syndrome. And then years later, they said, I think you have CRPS because this isn't the normal pain signals you should be feeling in your legs. And they sent me for that three-phase bone study. So that surgeries can happen is absolutely there. Sadly, you feel kind of hopeless. So I think one of the most important questions that I would have for you today is, when a patient comes to you, where do you begin? Because obviously you don't jump to surgery, which I love, but where do you begin when a patient walks into your office?
Well, hopefully I begin where most everyone else does, but unfortunately I know that's not the case, having talked to all these patients. But everything starts from the beginning of when they walk in the office. Hopefully, number one, you're providing them with a comfortable environment. So that literally means making sure your front desk person is not going to be miserable or having any, they're like, oh, fill out these forms and when you're ready, let me know. So even taking something down to that nuance of understanding that that person's first interaction in your office is going to be important at setting the tone for how everything else may go. Now, everyone has bad days, everyone, da-da-da, but I think that, being cognizant of that fact, and, even something I just thought of now, which I didn't do, but I'm probably going to do in the future because I just thought of it, is if I know I'm having a Crips patient coming in and I know where they've come from, I might tell my front desk person, hey, listen, when this person comes in, zero negativity, zero, let's treat them with a little, let's say kid gloves, because they've probably been through the ringer. So that's where it starts, hopefully. And then, you have to make sure you're getting all the information you can possibly digest. Now, one of the problems is when you're in practice, an insurance practice. And what I mean by that is, you're seeing a lot of patients a day to make a living because the insurance companies are the devil. And we all know that. They're criminals. They're legit criminals,
Right.
which is why there's so much, that's another subject about doctor burnout and increased suicide rates and all that
Oh,
stuff.
wow.
You have to be able to give the patient enough time with you that you're going to be able to extract the information. And sometimes, again, if you're in the insurance environment, it may not happen in the first visit. So I think the first visit is more foundational, where you're trying to get to know them, know what brought them there, where they've come from. So the history is always important, right? And that's common with anyone. But you have to get their diet, what are they eating on a regular basis? A lot of people will eat the opposite of what they should be eating because it's comfort food for them. It's, oh, I'm in so much pain. I must do something to get my brain happy. And so instead of, cocaine or heroin or meth, I'm going to have a Kit Kat, a Snickers, and a whole pint of ice cream, right? And that's normal. That's a normal behavior for humans. That when they're feeling down, they need to do something to take their mind off their pain or whatever's going on. So they do this. And so while you have to understand that behavior pattern is there, you have to break it. It's very important to break it because what you put in your mouth is just as important as, everything else that goes on. So if you don't have that foundation of a good nutrition status, then you're going to be fighting up river to deal with everything else that comes along. And most patients are amenable to it. Some just say, no, I don't care. I don't want to, I want to eat my ice cream. And that's fine. That's your choice. I'm not going to change it. But what I always say to patients is, listen, I can get you where you need to be most likely, and not necessarily Crips per se, but I can get you where you need to be if you listen to me. And if you want to listen to me, if you don't, that's fine too. Just let me know. I don't want to waste my time or waste your time doing things that aren't going to help either of us. And so people get that. And so after we look at their diet, and I do a diet diary with almost every patient where I say, let me see what you're eating and drinking for a week, and then we'll evaluate it. Interestingly enough, I've never done the data on this, but I can tell you 95% of my patients who I do a diet diary on, they get a C minus or less.
I would imagine that to be pretty accurate.
Yeah. I've been doing diet diaries for 2 years, and I think one person got an A.
Wow.
And I've done over, I don't know, hundreds of them.
You know, this sounds like your next study. This would be a
What?
great one.
Yeah, well, I mean, we already know this, right? I mean,
Yeah.
how much of our country is pre-diabetic or diabetic, right?
Absolutely.
So once we get the diet down, then I want to know about their stress level. And that includes how much they're sleeping or not sleeping. What is their quality of sleep? Sleep is very important. So if you're not getting sleep and you're not getting quality sleep, then your ability to regenerate, when you're sleeping, which is what it's primarily there for, for your cells to regenerate and everything's going to kind of repair itself. If you're not able to do that, that's something we have to look at too. And very frequently with CRIPS patients, they're on a lot of different medications that, are targeted to try to help them sleep, but the reality is they don't, or they're taking other meds that are counteracting their ability to sleep. So you have to look at that, and that's part of the history. And then their stress level. I don't know any CRIPS patients who say they have a normal stress level. So then you have like the CRIPS version of stress level, right? And so depending upon what it is, you kind of dig a little deeper into that and understand, do they have family members that are adding to their stress level, or are they taking away from their stress level? And you don't want family members adding to their stress level, which is frequently the case, because either, they're just not empathetic people, or they don't understand, or whatever the case may be, you have to at least figure that out. So if a person doesn't have that support in their own family or surrounding structure, then it's very important to get them involved with a psychologist or psychiatrist or support group at the very least, like the Crips Warriors, to be able to hopefully give them some sort of support system that's positive for them, because it can be very frustrating and lead you down a really bad rabbit hole if you let it go there. So that's important to delve into that aspect of it. So once you've gotten the nutrition, the mental status, the stress, their environment that they're in, then you can start focusing on treatments that they've had, what has worked, what hasn't worked, and then come up with your own treatment plan, whatever that's going to be, depending upon what's going on, So if they have, depending upon which type of CRIPS they have, can help lead you down the pathway of maybe finding that source. And, it used to be 10, 15 years ago, never operate on a CRIPS patient. You'll make them worse. And that is not the case. We know that's not the case now. If we can identify the source of that CRIPS and fix it, it doesn't always work, but we don't necessarily shy away from that. So that's sort of how I assess these patients when they come in the office and decide, what pathway we're going to go down.
I will tell you, from personal experience, there are still many doctors out there that hear this is a CRPS patient, I'm not working with them. It's just like this instantaneous response. And I think that's partially fear-based. They don't want to make you worse. Like they don't want to make you worse. They want to make you better in general. Most doctors, that's what they strive for. So hearing, oh, they already have CRPS, nothing I'm going to do on them is going to work. I'm just not going to touch it. I just had this with a hip surgery and I talked to him. I said, look, you're one of the best that I've heard about. How about you work with my pain specialist and you guys figure out a way to make it happen? And he talked to my pain specialist, who's an anesthesiologist, and they worked together to make sure that having the surgery was going to be okay and I wouldn't be impacted. And I wasn't. So do you find that these patients come in and say, would you talk to my other doctors? Or do they feel like he finally gets me?
I think it's a combination of both, that there's a subset of doctors, whether they're podiatrists, orthopedic surgeons, pain doctors, even pain doctors, who really don't know that much about CRIPS. They know enough, but not enough, where they're not comfortable treating them because either they feel, like you said, they don't want to make them worse, or they're just, that's not their practice. They don't want to fill their office with those people because, CRIPS patients definitely require more TLC, more time. And again, hearkening back to what I said earlier, insurance companies do not make it easy for you to treat CRIPS patients because, frankly, you have an overhead in your office. You're trying to pay your staff. You're trying to have the best care available. You're trying to do this. You're trying to make a living, feed your family. And an insurance company is paying you $50 to treat a patient. how much time can you give them for $50 without losing money? And the answer is probably 10, 15 minutes tops, you know, if you're not losing money. So that's unfortunate. It is what it is. And so frequently I will have to communicate with other doctors. I will get them involved if I have to, especially if I'm going to operate on a patient, just to help co-manage them once they come out of surgery, whether it's with the narcotic medications they're taking, the ketamine that we're going to be using, you know, whatever it is, you know. And also, I think you have to not have the fear of making them worse as long as your plan is sound and the patient is on board. Okay. You know, if you have a patient who, and that leads into something I know we're going to talk about later or soon, you don't want to have a patient in a situation where they have no hope. They go down that rabbit hole when they're told, I can't help you. And I don't know what to do for you. Patient leaves an expert who they were counting on to help them. And they leave and they go, well, if that person can't help me, you know, what am I going to do?
Absolutely. And we absolutely will get to that. I cannot wait for that part of the discussion. There is one thing that I'd like to move through first, and that's we had just started about the holistic, the diet, the mental, the stress. And I'm very interested in continuing the segments of the body, if you will, if we can talk about from literally ground up. So the role of podiatry in CRPS patients and what that role entails and how you work with patients from ground up.
Yeah. So, you know, biomechanics is a really big part of podiatry. That's what really separates our discipline from even orthopedic surgeons who are foot and ankle specialists or, you know, anyone else. Our grounding is in biomechanics. So if someone has really bad flat feet or really bad high arched feet, the opposite, that can affect their nerves because now you're tethering nerves or stretching nerves beyond their norm. And anything you do that affects nerves is going to affect a CRPS patient. So it is important to biomechanically look at a patient. I remember one time I was talking to a surgeon who was not a podiatrist, and he was so ignorant of biomechanics that he said something to the effect of, well, it's a good thing biomechanics has nothing to do with doing surgery in the legs. When I heard him say that, it kind of solidified what I had already thought about this person. And so I knew he wasn't a good person to begin with. And I knew that his knowledge was only focused on sort of one area. And so that was just, you know, unfortunate that this person has that mentality. But so to get back to podiatry. So once you've biomechanically assessed the patient and hopefully you watch them walk, and very often CRPS patients cannot walk really well. They're often using some sort of assistance, whether it's a walker or crutches or a wheelchair even. You know, even that comes into the picture. Like, is whatever they're using to help them ambulate good enough for them? Can you improve upon that? Would they be better off in an AFO device, which is an ankle foot orthosis that can help them walk better, give them better balance, help their foot move up if they have a foot drop? So all of these things have to be evaluated when you're looking at someone to help them get around. Sometimes those things can make you worse. So you have to be aware of that. If you're giving it to somebody as an assistive device, you have to, you know, kind of ease into it and wade into the pool very slowly and maybe do little tweaks here and there as they move along. Also, as the podiatrist, again, they're almost always working with a pain management specialist if you haven't interacted with them already and you don't know. So you have to find out and then work with their specialists or other specialists, whoever they are, as part of the team. You know, now you're jumping on as part of the team that's treating this person. And you want to make sure that you're not going to, you know, cross over into an area that's going to adversely affect whatever else they have going on. You want to do that in a positive way and vice versa. And so then let's say you have someone who's coming to you and they don't have the diagnosis of complex regional pain syndrome, but they're coming in with something that sounds like it, but they haven't been officially diagnosed and they're not really sure. then it's your job as a podiatrist to identify it to begin with, right? So there was a case not too long ago that I saw where it didn't register with me right away that it was complex regional pain syndrome, because none of the classic signs were there. And they had seen a bunch of other doctors already without the diagnosis of that. So it didn't really pop on my radar when I first saw it. Unfortunately, part of my team that I use a physiatrist. And for those who don't know what a physiatrist is, it's basically a medical doctor who is basically a physical therapist. So they have they're an MD, they go to medical school, but they also have a very deep knowledge of kinesiology and biomechanics and other things like that. And so the one that I work with, he's very good. And so when I sent this patient to have some nerve testing done, he said to me, "I think this person has Cripps." And I was like, "Yeah, I don't know." And so we once he had the testing done, even though it wasn't classic, we diagnosed this person with complex regional pain syndrome. And now this person, the targeting of that treatment could be zeroed in on, and I'm making sure they follow up with someone who knows how to treat complex regional pain syndrome back in Tennessee, where they're from, because they came to me from Tennessee because of, my specialty in nerve. And so podiatry by itself, probably much like an orthopedic surgeon by themselves, probably doesn't get enough training in identifying and dealing with complex regional pain syndrome, especially in their pre-residency training. So for me, when I went on to become involved with the Association of Extremity Nerve Surgeons, this is where I sort of, got a full-blown introduction into complex regional pain syndrome and how to treat it, and had and saw people discussing it. And I wound up going to pain meetings as opposed to podiatry meetings, and learning from anesthesiologists and pain doctors how they treat it, how they see it, how they classify it. So I don't think you can say that, podiatry as a whole, or orthopedics as a whole, or even internal medicine as a whole, has a very good exposure to it unless they've been exposed to it and have some sort of personal thing going on, or take an interest in it so they can advance their education.
That's extraordinary. I wish more doctors, more surgeons, more of anybody who can help, especially nutritionists, would take interest in it. And I feel like having people who go to those crossover conventions or meetings, the more crossover we get, the more understanding I think we'd have. So with the cross education that you allowed yourself to be encompassed with the pain side of things, do you think that that opened your eyes to see CRPS in patients you may not have seen it before, or just gave you a more thorough understanding of what to look for and how to look for it?
Good question. And the answer is both. I was able to have my senses a little bit heightened to look for it, despite what I said earlier about that one case where I just didn't see it right away because it was very subtle. But that case will reinforce me to next time I see something similar, I will say, okay, I have to rule this out. So getting exposed to that was very helpful from just broadening my knowledge base. And being able to identify and offer different treatment that I probably wouldn't have. But also within the AENS, the Association of Extremity Nerve Surgeons, having thought leaders and pioneers in the world of pain come in and lecture to us every year was also really super helpful.
I hope for everyone's sake that more of that crossover can happen and it's encouraged. And I have no doubt that working with the foundation gives you that opportunity to say, hey, we have these speakers, we have resources. They can come in, they can talk to us about what we should be looking for. Do you have any plans in the future of maybe being one of those mentors? Are you one of those mentors?
Well, I mean, I'm a mentor in some ways to all of our students and fellows of the AENS. And I'm sure I could speak on my own experience of dealing with people in complex regional pain syndrome. But presently, I don't think that my knowledge of the physiology, the different current exact protocols, et cetera, quite honestly, with my scope of practice, I don't think that I can, I would not want to be sort of the team leader of someone with complex cranial pain syndrome. I still need to be part of the team, but with that same token, I hope that what I'm learning and continue to learn, I can still add as the team member in that group to provide value to the patients when they come to a podiatrist or even better, if they come to someone who has been trained by the AENS.
We had mentioned briefly before that question about the role of podiatry. What do you do to get somebody who's at their wit's end, if you will? They have exhausted so many other options. They're almost going to see another doctor begrudgingly. I know that a lot of CRPS patients have medical PTSD, and it's difficult for us to trust another doctor and to start over. How do you take that exhausted patient and get them to calm their inner critic, if you will, and get them to start with you in that beginning phase diet and working forward?
Well, again, I just want to say it's not easy in the environment of insurance. If you're out of that environment, it's a lot easier. But if you're not, and many aren't, you have to be empathetic, number one. If you have a doctor who is not empathetic, you have next to zero chance of helping the patient you're describing. They're looking at their iPad or their laptop, and they're asking you questions, and they barely look up, and they're checking off numbers and, seeing what medications you're on. And, then they might at the end of it say, well, let's try this medication and, not in pain management, I'll just refer you out. So that's not going to work. So number one, you have to be empathetic. And even if you're not trained to be empathetic, and you can be more empathetic than you already are. Like if you're naturally somewhat empathetic, there are ways you can view things and learn to approach patients in a way that's disarming to them, so that the patient has to feel you're working with them and trying to help them. If they get the sense you're not, then they're going to turn you off and go down the pathway they've already been down to through a bunch of different ways. So, with that being said, that's where you learn if they're stressed. If they say their stress level is a 7 or whatever out of 10 every day, that's the first thing you're going to work on. How can we lower your stress level to get to a point where you can at least take in stuff and absorb it? And so, are you meditating every day? Well, what do you mean meditating? Are you taking at least a half hour out of your day to do something where no one else is interfering with your life? Whether it's sitting in a dark room, sitting in a tub with candles, or listening to, music or whatever, are you doing that and breathing, just taking some deep breaths? And if they're not doing that, that's step one. Okay. I remember listening to a guy who practices meditation and spent time with monks and all that stuff. And he said, in order for a human to really properly use meditation appropriately, they have to meditate for 4 to 6 hours a day. And
Four to
I a
six hours.
day. And I
Wow.
said, who on earth has time to do that? Nobody, except people who, I guess, they're independently wealthy, or they just don't need any money and they're living in a tent and can just go meditate all day like a monk.
Right.
So that's unrealistic. But if I can give someone a minimum of a half hour a day to decompress and do whatever, that's the first start. And then you build upon that, from there out, whatever that is. Again, finding out what stresses them out the most and trying to remove that from the equation. Then, if you're able to, if you have the tools in your toolbox to offer them things that they haven't had already, then that's going to give them the hope that they can hang on to buy in and say, okay, if I do this and I change my diet and I'm meditating more, then perhaps, when we go to put in a peripheral nerve stimulator, or when we try ketamine or whatever it is, maybe it's going to work better than if I'm trying to put it in an environment where I'm stressed out and, I'm not as low in my baseline where I need to be. So that's kind of where I would say.
As a warrior, you're absolutely right. There have been a handful of times where I've gone into a treatment very stressed and noticed that that particular treatment didn't work as well as it did on a day where I wasn't as stressed. Or I personally advocate for the anti-inflammatory diet of any kind, because the more carbs and sugar I eat, the more inflammation my body has, the more agitated the nerves are. And I know if I'm about to go get a treatment of some kind and I just had pasta the day before, or I just had, my birthday just passed, I had cake, the next couple of days, I can feel it in my body. I know. If I were to go get a treatment now, as opposed to with days prior where I was on a good diet and I felt great, the response my body gives is two totally different things.
Exactly. And sometimes, diet is not enough and you have to nutritionalize somebody. And so that's why it's important to get data when you can. One of the things I do is I DNA test patients to look at their DNA profile. And there's a couple of companies that do that. It's not cheap. It runs anywhere from like $400 to $700 for the test, but it's, gives you great information. Where you can learn what your body, where your genetic little defects are, which they call SNPs, with single nucleotide problem is what I call it, where there's like a, you have two copies of your DNA. Everyone has two copies. And if you have a defect in one of those copies, it's not the worst thing in the world. But if you have two defects at the same, then that's going to penetrate more. And then you have your environment, whatever you're eating, exposed to, that can trigger those defects. And so the DNA profile helps you look at that so that you can avoid triggering your defects.
Is that something that you would recommend any chronically ill patient do?
Yeah, I mean, I would recommend anyone do it, whether they're ill or not, just so they can know their profile and, not do anything that's going to make it worse. It's initially when you look at it, it's a little bit tough to sort of understand, and you have to know some genetics a little bit. But they've done a better job over the years of sort of dumbing it down so that if I send it to you, you can look at it and it'll say, okay, I see all these things. I don't really know what they mean, but they're telling me you need to avoid this and do this. And some of it's really common sense. Like, hey, you've got a sweet tooth. You need to stop eating so much candy and cake and ice cream and get on the treadmill or go out and take a walk, but some of it's a little more, specific, which is nice. And then you can supplement someone, whether it's giving them L-methylfolate, having them take more vitamin D, whatever it is, there are ways to do that. In fact, I just bought this book. It's like an inch and a half thick called, it's all about nutritional supplements. So it explains deficiencies and why this supplement is good and how you can detoxify on it. It's like the up-to-date version of that, which I'm trying to sink my teeth into, so that I have a better knowledge of understanding when I tell someone, hey, you need to take this supplement because you're deficient here, or this can help with this particular problem. And it's really something I'm not going to retain, so I'm just going to have to kind of use it as a reference once I've absorbed it a bit.
I think the supplementation aspect could be an entire podcast in and of itself.
Sure.
When I first got diagnosed, it was just as the MTHFR gene started being recognized more and more. And they tested me immediately for it because I was on so many different supplements. I've had bariatric surgery. So I was on all sorts of different supplements and I was getting sick. And they discovered that I had the double gene for the MTHFR, and the folic acid in my multivitamin was making me horribly sick, and all my levels were screwed up. So I feel like having that inch and a half thick book, even as reference, will definitely come in handy. And I think that DNA test, that one test, helped me feel immensely better. So I can only imagine what a full panel of a DNA test would do. So I think
Yeah.
that giving that recommendation would probably be a fantastic idea for any patient. You're right.
MTHFR, methyl tetrahydrofolate folate reductase is I heard about it probably 12 years ago, maybe somewhere 15, 12, 15 years ago. And at that time, there was like a couple of people who were really talking about it. And I believe it was mthfr.net. You know, at the time, just it was hard to get that tested. Now, most of the labs are doing it as a standard, like you can get it from your normal standard labs. And, you know, it's a very common defect that occurs. And, you know, treating it is wonderful because once you, again, it's like blood pressure, right? If you're running around, you don't check your blood pressure, you don't know what it is. You can't tell. You know, and by the time you have a stroke, it's too late. That's why you're testing for these things and the ability to test. I mean, we're probably only testing, you know, I don't know, 30% of what we can be testing for that we don't even know about. You know, I hope that number's not right, but you know, there's so many things that we can test for. And you know, maybe eventually one day we'll have a test for Cripps where we can go in and go, oh, you have this gene issue or this whatever. We'll just give you this little pill or inject you with this and it'll go away in a week. You know, we don't know, but you know, maybe you know, 20 years from now that'll be the case, or even as soon as 10 years now, we have AI working in the scenario if AI doesn't come out and kill us all.
Right, the Terminator will
Exactly.
come in insurance form first.
Yeah, it's already here.
Exactly. They just automatically deny everything. So that's got to be the start of it.
Yeah.
One of the ways that I think doctors have gained my trust personally is exactly what you're talking about. It's just sort of saying, okay, give me the time to work with you. Like, let's work on this together. And building that trust is super important. Do you think that there is something that you could say to a patient who maybe doesn't have that support system in their family, their husband or wife, their partner, that you can maybe give them a couple words of encouragement or what to do in the psychological aspect?
Yeah, I think that they have to understand they're not alone. And that's where the Cripps Warrior Foundation comes in, right? When you're feeling alone and no one understands you, that's like the worst thing you could have, right? So if there are other people who are in that same boat and i.e. are in the Warrior Foundation, and you can put them into that little pathway so that they can communicate with those people and feel they're not alone, that's really all you have to do, and make them understand that you know you've seen this before, you understand what they're going through. You may not feel what they're going through, you don't, you know, you're not in their shoes, so to speak, but you know you get it. And so I think it's always best if you can relate to someone if you've had what they've had. You know, unfortunately, I have not had Cripps and I hope I never get it, but I understand despair. I understand where your brain is at. Believe me, I've been in that area. You can tell the person, I'm not in your shoes. I don't live with you at home. I'm not dealing with your daily basis, but I'm again empathetic. I'm sympathetic to your problem, and I want to put you in a place where you can feel that you can communicate with other people who are going to bounce stuff off of you. And you know, it's not always necessarily healthy sometimes because you don't know who you're putting them in touch with, and sometimes people are not normal. You know, crazy people can have Cripps too. You know, even though Cripps people often get labeled crazy just because you can't see the disease, you can have crazy people who get Cripps and now you're in big trouble. So, but hopefully, fortunately, the Warrior Foundation you know, is a place where there's not too many crazy people, and if there are, maybe there's a way to screen them out so that if someone is creating a problem, they are no longer contributing negativity to that group.
And I think part of that negativity, crazy or not, I think part of that negativity is exactly what we've been talking about, is that length of time of not being understood, of not being heard. And it's just that feeling of despair that nobody understands, and it manifests into personality change to where this person is just negative about life in general. And it becomes sort of who they are. And part of the Warrior Foundation, the support group that we have, is allowing people the space to experience what they're experiencing and experience the feelings. But I know many of the other warriors try and walk each other out of the darkness, that this is just a moment in time. And even though the CRPS might not be over, this feeling of darkness and despair hopefully will end, and just to sort of keep going. And they're really good about trying to motivate each other. The amount of camaraderie is important in that support group, and being heard, being understood.
Many years ago, when I was in podiatry school, I had a professor who said, really smart guy, super smart, and one of the smartest people I knew. He said something to me because when I was in early medical school, I was getting these tinglings down the side of my face and having. It was almost like a trigeminal neuralgia type of thing. I didn't really understand it. It was going on for a few weeks, and I asked him about it, and he said it's probably just stress from studying in school and everything. He was right, but I at the time, when you're there's a disease that medical students at least used to say called something called Merckitis. The Merck Manual
Yes.
is a thick book, bigger than the Bible, about every medical disease known to man, and so. I'm in there reading because you can look up symptoms and everything. And I've got multiple sclerosis now or a brain tumor, And he said to me, he goes, Peter, you don't have a brain tumor. You don't have multiple sclerosis, but you go ahead and get an MRI because if you don't, and he said, this is what he said to me. He said, the mind is your enemy. Always think of the mind as your enemy because it's always trying to screw you. And I thought about that, and he was right. He's absolutely right. If you let it, the mind will be your enemy. And there's a guy named Dr. John Sarno who wrote a book. He's a chiropractor, wrote a book a long time ago. And the book was basically stating that 60 to 70% of all back pain and GERD was due to your mind. That basically your brain does not want to deal with mental pain. Your brain will take physical pain any day over mental pain. That's its way it's hardwired, the neocortex and the paleocortex, which basically means new and old. And so what it will do, it will give you back pain so that you don't think about your mental or emotional pain. It will give you GERD so you can take a pill and think about your pill and everything else that goes with that, so you don't have to think about the mental pain that you're going through. And so believe it or not, I think that's probably rings a little true with people with CRIPS, where they focus on all that physical pain that they're experiencing because they don't want to go down that well of how mentally traumatic it is going on for them. And so that's why you have to work on both sides and try to, really get your mind as good as you can, as difficult as it is.
The Body Keeps Score is the new book about the mind-body connection. Have you read that one yet?
I haven't, but I'm going to.
It is mind-boggling, no pun intended. It was a definite eye-opener. The Body Keeps Score, and about how, your past traumas manifest in physical ailments and physical issues. It's a phenomenal book, and it even has a workbook that goes with it. It was definitely an eye-opener. I think one of the most misunderstood parts about any disease that you have is where the psychological comes into play. Do you think that when you work with the patients and you're able to help center them in order to begin again, do you think that you see more positive results?
I don't have any data on that, obviously, but I can tell you yes, for sure. Definitely more positive, no question.
I think even just changing the mindset, or even changing just one little thing, a diet to reduce inflammation, would
Oh.
give most patients a positive outlook.
Doctors don't like to tell people they're overweight. Even in today's society, there's a whole subject on fat shaming. And what I do to try to, when someone comes in and they're overweight, whether it's 20 pounds or 200 pounds, I have to say, listen, The reason we're changing your diet is not because I want you to lose weight. Yes, I do want you to. Losing weight will be a byproduct of lowering the inflammation in your body and reducing the pain you're in. And I see it all the time where, a woman who might be 5'7", weighs 240 pounds. And I say, listen, here's where we have to start. As I mentioned earlier, this is what we're going to do. We're going to look at your diet. We're going to come back. We're going to change it. And then they come in like a month later and they say, oh, doc, I only lost like 4 pounds, but I feel so much better. Right. And so that's reinforcing what we're doing with them. And they're happy to continue on that pathway. And what's nice is if they go off that diet, they're going to feel like crap again. And then they're going to go, oh, he was right. I kind of call it the rule of threes. I don't think it was me who invented that. I'm sure I heard it somewhere, where I need 3 weeks for you to change your what you're doing, your paradigm shift. It's going to take 3 weeks for you to get off of whatever you're doing. Then it's going to take 3 months for you to realize fully what you've benefited from, so that when you try to go back and have a Coke or eat a cookie, it's going to taste disgustingly sweet to you because your body is no longer used to it. And then you're going to go, oh, okay, yeah, that's nasty. And everyone can experience that if they do it. And I'm sure you have.
Oh,
So,
yeah.
yeah. So once you do that, then you have the feedback mechanism going on and you can choose to listen to it or not. So for me, when I gone completely clean in my diet, I can. If I have a too much sugar, whatever that too much is, whether it's 2 grams, 3 grams, or 4 grams, I'll get a rash on my hand, or I'll get eczema pop up, just boom, just like that, or my eyes will itch, or I'll start phlegming up because that's inflammation, and that's how it manifests in my body. And that's I had the experience of undergoing that. Some people may get joint pain. Everyone's different, and so obviously, someone with Crips, they're going to flare up whatever. At the very least, you get someone on a good diet, again, whether they have Crips or not, at least they're starting from a place where they're going to benefit the most no matter what you're doing.
Absolutely. You have to have a healthy relationship with your scale in order to do this. If you eat something that is not right for your diet, pay attention to the scale for the next few days. It takes a week or 2 weeks to get rid of that, but it took 2 days for your body to create it. Is it
Absolutely.
worth it?
Yeah, right. That's what you have to remember that scenario. Is it worth it? Because it's not. And I have a whole sheet that I spent a lot of time getting it down to one sheet that I give my patients on diet and nutrition, where it has references that I recommend, podcasts that I recommend people listen to, that's supportive, and also my recommendations for supplementation and even cookbooks. Unfortunately, again, in our world here, it's way cheaper to eat crappy than it is to eat healthy, which is also a problem.
Absolutely. It often is. If you could give a recommendation to a CRPS patient or anybody who's chronically ill for that matter, do you think that the overall anti-inflammatory type diet is basically the go-to, or do you have something else that you prefer?
Yeah, I mean, I like the anti-inflammatory diet. That's sufficient. But if you want to sort of take it to the next level, I have people read two books and I tell them combine the information from both for you because one book leans more vegan and the other one leans more meat. And no one, I personally don't think anyone should be a vegan completely because I don't think it's good for you. But there are some people, a subset that probably should. We're meant to eat meat. Realistically, and listen, I'm the biggest animal lover on the planet. Animals eat animals, right? So, the idea that humans shouldn't eat animals is kind of ludicrous in that regard, as far as, from a evolution standpoint. What I think about, there are definitely things that I don't eat because of my stance on loving animals, but it's not for everyone. So the two books that I recommend, one is The Bulletproof Diet by Dave Asprey. And the other one is Cleanse to Heal by William Anthony. And so if you read both of those books, you're going to get a really good basic knowledge of what you need to do to bring your body to full, its best functional level. At least that's, currently what I feel. And then there's even a website for people who are addicted to processed food. called, I think it's called processed processfoodaddiction.com or something like that. If you look it up, it's on there. But it's basically a support group, like the Warrior Group, for people who are addicted to processed food, whether it's McDonald's or Doritos or Velveeta cheese, whatever. It can, there's people in there, that can, or ice cream, that can help you out. And again, it's letting you know that there's someone else out there with your same deal who's trying not to go into their freezer to get ice cream out.
Processed food addict is definitely something, especially here in the States, that is a big problem. A big problem. I miss the in New York where I lived. There used to be a fruit and vegetable stand, and it was busy every single day. And we didn't at the time on Long Island, we didn't have as many fast food restaurants right around us. I just went back a year ago and yeah, the stands are gone, and where they used to stand is now a Taco Bell, a Dunkin' Donuts, a White Castle, and something else. And I was like, well, okay. I guess it's busier than it used to be, and that's what people wanted. So, but I do miss those little fruit and vegetable stands, and finding a farmer's market where you can get fresh is probably the best way to do it.
Yeah, and
So.
that's what both of those books indicate when you're reading about them. I mean, that's the cornerstone of any, good nutritious meal is not eating anything processed.
I really think that nutrition is going to have to be a podcast in and of itself.
Oh, for sure.
With everything that we've discussed today, and I thank you so much. If there was one thing, one takeaway that you'd want a listener to have, what would that be?
Probably make sure if you have the diagnosis or you think you have the diagnosis, you find someone who is empathetic and knows about Crips more than just what it is. They're treating it on a regular basis. If that means you have to travel to go see that person, then that's what you're going to do. Do not rely on, oh, if my primary care doctor sent me to this doctor who knows next to nothing about it. No. The first question you should ask anyone who's going to try to treat you is, how many patients a year do you have treating with Crips? And if they say that number is, less than five, you probably don't want to see that person. I would tell them that's number one. And number two, get your mind right, whatever that means. You have to be on the positive side of every day. Put yourself in a situation, whatever, however best you can, so that your mind is going in a positive direction and that you're not getting in a scenario where you have no hope for whatever reason, whatever that takes for you to do that. We all have our bad days, people with and without Crips. It's harder to do when you have Crips to have better days, but that's where you need more support. If you don't have that problem, you can, go pet your dog and you'll probably be better. But sometimes that's not enough. And so, do whatever you have to do to get yourself in that positive, where that arrow is in the green, not in the red.
There is one question that I want to go back to. As you look at a patient and you begin holistically, I assume that your last resort, if you will, is going to be surgery. Is there ever a time where you're like, you know what, it's going to have to be surgery or decompression of this nerve, or do you start everybody in the same place?
No, I mean, I can tell you for sure on people who do not have Crips, I absolutely have that feeling because again, there's no fear, right? There's zero fear that I'm going to make them worse. Could it happen? Yeah, but it doesn't enter my mind. With a Crips patient, yes, there are definitely times where if they've had an incident and it's clear that that incident caused their Crips, and it just wasn't addressed, a nerve problem in this case, right? That if I go in and decompress that nerve, or if it's a neuroma, I take it and I bury it somewhere and do what I have to do to make it be quiet, then yeah. I'll tell that patient, listen, we can do all this other stuff that's probably not going to work, that's not surgical, if you want, whether it's injecting stem cells or trying ketamine or TMS therapy, you name it, we can do all that. I don't think it's going to work. But if you don't want to do surgery, that's fine. and we'll wait and do whatever you want to do. But yeah, there are definitely times where I feel surgery is the best option and it should be done sooner than later.
Is there ever a time that you would be more concerned that I really shouldn't do a surgery, or is that a matter of weighing it out in the end?
No, I think that, the longer you're in practice, whether it's Crips or not, there are certain patients who fall into a category of they're not going to handle surgery well. And I have one right now that just popped into my head who does not have Crips, I don't think. And she had surgery by an orthopedic surgeon like a year and a half ago and just regretted it ever since then. And was complaining of pain and sent me an email this morning. I on her about 5 months ago for nerve release, which is doing well. But what often happens is patients don't remember 6 months ago how bad they were. They just remember how they are today. And so sometimes you have to go back and show them how bad they were so they realize where they came from. And that's just normal, right? It's like relative, right? Well, I'm better than I was, but I'm still not great. And so you get a sense, again, being in practice for a while, of who might be that person that's not going to do well with surgery, regardless of their diagnosis. And so you want to avoid those people because they're not going to do well no matter what you do to them. And these are typically people who've had seven surgeries already, trying to go in there and be a hero and be the eighth doctor who's going to somehow help them. Since I really try not to do surgery on them, unless, like you said, you can identify something that was missed and you can fix them, as opposed to, they've seen some smart people and they weren't able to be helped. So what makes you think you're going to do any different? So you have to weigh all that stuff out. But yes, there are definitely patients where you don't want to touch, for fear of not making them worse, but also for fear that you're just, not going to do something that's going to benefit them.
Very good point. Very good point. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch upon?
Yeah, the only thing I would say is that, there are always new techniques, new procedures, new pathways being identified. And so that whether you've had Crips for 10 years, 20 years, 2 months, you have to do what we talked about earlier so that when the time comes where some sort of treatment protocol or modality or whatever is going to come around that's going to be able to get you back where you need to be, you're going to hang in there until then. And when you have those bad days, you're going to have them, just got to hang in there.
That's a really good point. I really look forward to chatting with you again. I cannot thank you enough for your time today.
Well, it was my pleasure. Anything I can do to create the awareness, make the awareness better for everybody, and hopefully provide everybody who is part of the group some knowledge and hope. That's the most important thing.
Absolutely. And hopefully, someday soon, I'll be able to chat with you in person, shake your hand. Thank you for everything that you've done for the Warriors and for the Warrior Foundation. So, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Happy to do so, and I look forward to that as well.
Have a wonderful weekend.
Danielle and Dr. Bregman, thank you so much for that information-filled episode where we can all learn something new that can benefit us. We invite you to join us on the 15th for our next new episode. Our brand new resource, Quinn Gutierrez, is going to be our guest. He is a life coach and has a message of beautiful hope to share with us. If you would like to support the podcast and the foundation, you can do so by texting CWF Podcast, all caps, no spaces, to 53555. We look forward to continuing to deliver exciting episodes with new information and resources for warriors to reach out to. You can reach out to us on our website at any time, crpswarriorsfoundation.org. Please don't hesitate to reach out to us for anything that you may need. We're all here to help and support warriors and to raise awareness. Please subscribe and share. We'll see you on the 15th.